incredibly dangerous to be an environmental activist around the globe. Between 2002 and 2013, at least 908 activists were killed because of their environmental work. This is according to a new report from the investigative nonprofit Global Witness. That's an average of at least one environmentalist murdered every week. In the last 4 years, that rate has doubled. And those numbers are probably low because in many parts of the world, human rights monitoring is prohibited. On today's Your Call, we'll talk about why the number of murders is on the rise, how are governments responding, and we'll also talk about what environmentalists here in the United States are facing. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Julie Candler. King Juan Carlos, who helped secure Spain's transition from dictatorship to democracy, is abdicating after nearly 40 years on the throne. He said the moment was right to pass on the role to his son, Crown Prince Felipe. Guy Hedgecoe reports from Madrid.
In explaining his decision to Spaniards in a televised address, the king said it was time to make way for the next generation. He said that Crown Prince Felipe, who is 46, is ideally prepared to take the throne. King Juan Carlos has been a hugely significant figure in public life since becoming monarch in 1975, helping usher in democracy after the death of dictator Francisco Franco. However, in recent years, the king's health has deteriorated, and he and the royal family have suffered a string of scandals. Following his abdication announcement, Republican groups have organised demonstrations across Spain tonight to call for an end to the monarchy.
Ukraine's border service says hundreds of insurgents have carried out a sustained assault near the eastern city of Luhansk. Reports say five insurgents were killed and at least seven guards have been injured. Steve Rosenberg is following events from Donetsk.
Ukrainian border guard service said that several hundred pro-Russia militants were trying to storm a border guards camp in Luhansk with mortars, rocket launchers and machine guns. There was a brief ceasefire, but it collapsed and the battle resumed. Later, fire engines and ambulances rushed to the centre of Luhansk. There'd been an explosion at the regional administration building that's now being used as the headquarters of the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic. It's not clear what caused the blast.
The investigator appointed by world football's governing body FIFA to examine Qatar's winning bid to stage the 2022 World Cup says he'll finish gathering evidence within a week. This follows allegations of widespread corruption by Qatar to win support for its bid. Our sports editor David Bond has the details.
Amid growing calls for a rerun of the vote for the 2022 World Cup, FIFA's chief investigator Michael Garcia was in Oman today to interview the leaders of Qatar's organising committee. The meeting had already been scheduled before the Sunday Times published the latest allegations of wrongdoing. The paper claims Mohammed bin Hammam, Qatar's former FIFA vice president, paid £3 million in alleged bribes to football officials to build support for Qatar's bid. Qatar denies the allegations, but the BBC understands that some of the Sunday Times evidence will now be passed to Mr. Garcia's inquiry.
The Israeli cabinet has denounced the newly formed Palestinian Unity government, ruling out negotiations and authorising possible sanctions. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, accused the Palestinian President, Mahmoud Abbas, of saying yes to terror by creating a joint administration with Hamas. World News from the BBC. India's Minister for Women has said that dealing with rape is her top priority. Manika Gandhi spoke as protests continued in response to the gang rape and hanging of two teenage girls in Uttar Pradesh last week. Work has begun in Japan on a huge underground ice wall to prevent the contamination of water at the wrecked Fukushima nuclear reactor. From Tokyo, Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
This is the latest and most ambitious plan to isolate and contain the nuclear disaster at Fukushima. More than 1,500 pipes will be inserted deep into the ground around the ruined reactor buildings. Coolant will then be pumped through the pipes and the ground around them will gradually freeze solid. If it works, it should form a solid ice wall 30 metres deep and over 1.5 kilometres long. The aim of the wall is to keep groundwater from leaking into the reactors and becoming contaminated with radiation. At the moment, several hundred tonnes of groundwater seeps in every day.
The Egyptian satirist Bassem Youssef has announced he's ending his massively popular television show, which has ridiculed his country's politicians. Mr. Youssef said he'd rather finish the show than have it watered down. Sebastian Usher reports.
A household name across the Arab world, Bassem Youssef was a symbol of the optimism and freedom that the Arab Spring once promised. But the pressure he and his show have come under in the past 2 years tells a gloomier story. Mr. Youssef mercilessly mocked Egypt's Islamist president Mohamed Morsi with huge public backing. The Islamist tried to close his show down, but it survived, his case being fiercely championed by his American counterpart John Stewart. But the military-backed government that replaced Mr. Morsi was no keener on his humour. Now with the former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi about to assume power, the leeway for his brand of satire appears to have shrunk further.
BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The latest report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warns that global warming could spiral, quote, out of control and lead to environmental disasters such as water shortages, killer heat waves in Europe, wildfires here in the United States, droughts in Australia, and deadly flooding in Mozambique. But what's escaping international attention on the effects of global warming is the increasing danger for environmental and land activists who are working to protect the environment and in many instances, their livelihoods. According to the investigative nonprofit Global Witness, at least 908 environmental activists around the globe were murdered in retaliation for their work between 2002 and 2013. On average, one activist is killed every week. So why are so many environmental activists being killed? What explains the rise in the numbers? Who's killing them? And how are governments responding? Only 10 perpetrators are known to have been convicted and punished between 2002 and 2013. Today, we're joined by Oliver Courtney, senior campaigner with Global Witness and lead author of the report, Deadly Environment, the Dramatic Rise in Killings of Environmental and Land Defenders. And he joins us from London. Hi, Oliver. Welcome to the show.
Hello there. Thank you very much.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Simeon Teagle. He is Global Post senior correspondent for South America. Simeon writes about a broad range of themes across Latin America and specializes in the environment. And he joins us from Peru. Hi, Simeon. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me on.
It's nice to have you. So, Oliver, I want to start off with you. This number, 908, is the number of environmentalists killed between 2002 and 2013. But I understand that's probably a low number because in many parts of the globe, these numbers aren't monitored. Human rights monitoring is prohibited. And then when you look at war-torn areas, it's incredibly difficult to get the numbers. So first off, how did you come up with 908?
Hi there. Yeah, thank you for having us on. Our research was based on a process of desk research. So we scoured what we could find publicly available in the public domain, and then working with local partners on the ground in countries where we know this kind of issue to be a problem. So Global Witness does a huge amount of work on deforestation, on land grabs, on mining-related issues, and the corruption and human rights abuse that comes with that. And as a result, we have established relationships with groups who work in countries where these issues are particularly predominant. We worked with many of those groups to affirm what we could and to corroborate the evidence we could. But what was very clear was that it was very hard to find reliable evidence and certainly to verify it. The people who are the people in question here who are getting killed defending their right to the land and the environment are often working in some of the remotest and most risky parts of the world where laws are either weak or non-existent. That makes it extremely difficult to report on and certainly to do so with any sense of certainty or safety. So one of the things which we're most keen to make is we really think the statistics that we've uncovered and the number that we were able to identify, whilst deeply alarming in what it says about what's going on in the world, land, forest, and other environmental sectors, really is just the tip of the iceberg. And that's why we want to shine a light on this problem and make an urgent call for international action.
In your report, you point out that this issue doesn't really get much attention. And one of the main questions is, if this number is so big, why is no one talking about it? Why do you think this doesn't get much attention? I mean, 908 activists killed, and as you say, the number's probably a lot higher because in so many parts of the world, human rights monitoring is just not allowed.
That's certainly part of the problem. Underlying that, in our analysis, is a sense of pervasive secrecy in how these kind of large deals for resources like timber and land and other agribusiness related sectors, there are mining, there are any number of natural resource sectors. We noticed in this piece of work and in our work over the last 20 years that secrecy in the way these deals are done is a major problem. They're too often done behind closed doors between governments keen to encourage outside investment and unscrupulous companies who are striking deals for natural resources without consenting or even communicating with the people who live on the land and often who've lived on it for generations and are utterly reliant on it for their livelihoods and for all sorts of cultural reasons as well. And that brings local groups and communities and indigenous peoples in particular into conflict with some very powerful vested interests. And we think that what we found is a very stark indicator of how big a problem that is and how ordinary people are increasingly on the front line of the battle for the world's natural resources.
And you tell specific stories in your report, and we'll talk about those stories this hour. But where are these deaths happening the most? What really stood out for you in this report?
It's our analysis is that it's very much a global problem, but it does appear to be especially acute in both Latin America and Asia Pacific. Brazil was by some distance the worst affected country that we were able to identify. It accounts for almost half of the killings in our data set. We think there's two reasons why the incidence is so high, and there are many reasons, but there are two which really stand out. One is that it's particularly badly affected by many of the problems that we uncovered, land-related issues and conflict over land and conflict over deforestation and logging are particularly acute in Brazil. We also think it's important to highlight that Brazil and indeed Latin America more generally tends to have a very strong civil society presence, which is working very closely on these issues, partly because they are such issues for people in those countries. And so there tends to be better monitoring and better reporting. So whilst we do think Latin America is particularly acutely affected, we would also like to highlight the fact that there are almost certainly other parts of the world where this problem is occurring a large amount and where cases are probably going even more unnoticed. In parts of the world like Africa, Russia, China, we haven't been able to find a lot of information we can verify about those parts of the world related to this issue. We don't think that's because it's not happening. We think it's because it's difficult for people to report on it and because the structures aren't in place for them to allow them to do so and to give them the support they need. So that's one of the reasons why we wanted to put the research we have.
Oliver Courtney is senior campaigner with Global Witness and lead author of the report Deadly Environment, The Dramatic Rise in Killings of Environmental and Land Defenders. And Simeon, you're in Peru. There's also a number of activists have been killed there. It's incredibly high. First off, can you talk a little bit about environmental activism in Peru? What do you see on a regular basis there?
Well, I think in terms of Latin America as a region, one of the things to bear in mind about why the rates of homicide against or killings of environmental activists is so high is that Latin America, just as a region, has the highest homicide rates in the world. So part of the context is it's not just environmentalists. But here specifically in Peru, I think Peru's a mining superpower. It's a developing country with a population of 30 million, but exports huge amounts of gold, silver, and other metals. So mining is just a fundamental, huge part of the economy here. And a lot of the conflicts that we're seeing in Peru are about mining. And that's in a context, I would say, where local communities are really just not consulted, they're ignored, about the decisions, the big decisions about what that will affect their land. And I think, I mean, just one story that really sums that up is that the previous president, Alan Garcia, who was in power from 2006 to 2011, whenever there were complaints from rural communities about their land and conflicts with corporations and mining and other companies, the analogy he used for that was in Spanish, El perro de hortelano, which is, if you remember Aesop's fables, that's the story about the dog in the manger. And the story is that this was a dog lying in the manger with grain there. It wouldn't eat it, but it wouldn't let the horse that was also there in the stable eat it either. It barked at the horse. So this is the president of Peru basically accusing some of the most vulnerable people in the country, indigenous people, campesinos, of basically just not wanting to use their land properly and being jealous of any corporation that comes along and tries to use it. So you have that at the political level. You have what is almost an encouragement or a validation, I think, within Peruvian culture of just dismissing rural communities and refusing to take them seriously.
You wrote recently about a number of activists in Latin America who've been killed. Can you tell us a specific story? You wrote about Chico Mendez, for example. You also wrote about a recent slaying of Noe Vasquez in Veracruz in eastern Mexico. There was one that's getting a lot of attention in Costa Rica, Ayara Mora Sandoval, a 26-year-old who attempted to stop the poaching of endangered leatherback turtle eggs on Caribbean beaches. Which one stands out for you?
Well, I mean, they're all terrible, of course, but I mean, if I was going to pick one, maybe it would be the last one you mentioned, Jairo Mora, in Costa Rica. He was a 26-year-old biology student who was killed last October, and basically he'd gone to monitor turtle eggs on a beach that was increasingly being targeted by poachers. He went with three women. I think they were Spanish and American, the women. The women were tied up, and he was basically, they took him off, some gunmen who just appeared out of nowhere, and he was found the next day. His body was found naked on the beach, and I think, I mean, the reason I would highlight that is because Costa Rica, of all the countries in Latin America, is one that has this reputation for being, first of all, relatively safe, right, by the standards of Latin America, but also a country that has is very environmentally aware. And so I think, I mean, what's interesting to me that a murder like that can happen in Costa Rica, and initially, at least, the authorities there didn't want to take the killing seriously, or at least not the possibility that Mora had been killed because he was doing environmental work. They initially talked about cocaine traffickers using that beach as a transit point. And so, I mean, for me, I think the thing is, if something like that can happen in Costa Rica, then what does that tell us about other countries that are, frankly, much, much more dangerous with much weaker institutions and just much higher levels of violence?
And in Costa Rica, I understand that Mora was also tortured, according to reports.
He might have been. I don't know the full details of that. I mean, one of the things, I mean, when his body was found, he was naked. He'd apparently been hit in the head with a blunt object, and his mouth was also full of sand. So the precise details beyond that, I don't know. But clearly he was, at the very least, his body was in some way mistreated as well.
How has the government responded to this in Costa Rica?
That's a good question. I mean, they were I think it was the vice president of Costa Rica was talking about it being the beach that where he was killed as being used as a transit point by drug dealers. So initially, at least, there was a resistance to even taking it seriously. The fact that he'd been he was targeted because he'd basically been getting in the way of his environmental work, had been getting in the way of people who basically would rather have been selling turtle eggs for $1 each in local markets.
And Oliver, what's striking about this report is that only 10 perpetrators are known to have been convicted and punished between 2002 and 2013. Your report found that 99% of the deaths went unpunished. Why is that happening? I mean, why aren't governments responding to these murders?
No, it's an excellent question, and it's certainly one of the reasons why we've undertaken the research we have, is because we feel like there isn't enough attention on the problem, and certainly not enough is being done to investigate what's happening to these people, and certainly to see justice for their families and see their killers brought to justice. I think one of the main things that it's worth pointing out is that those levels of impunity feed further violence. They have a chilling effect on environmental activism, and activism of all sorts, indeed. And that in itself makes it extremely difficult for people to continue protesting against the encroachment on their land or on their right to a healthy environment. Often, we found in our analysis that it's the very people who should be protecting their citizens and standing up for their rights who are involved in their abuse, whether or not that's the presence of networks of vested interest at a political level, or whether or not that's the involvement of state forces and authorities, men with guns, who should be protecting people and who are actually involved in carrying out violence and abuses against them. I think it's also worth mentioning that whilst 908 killings is a high number, what lies behind those killings, and we're sure there are more of them in their own right, but what lies behind the killings is a whole range of intimidation and abuses which have this detrimental effect on activism, and which stop people from standing up for their rights, and ultimately which will mean that the environment that they're trying to protect gets destroyed even faster.
That is Oliver Courtney, senior campaigner with Global Witness and lead author of the new report, Deadly Environment, The Dramatic Rise in Killings of Environmental and Land Defenders. The report found that at least 908 environmental activists worldwide were murdered in retaliation for their work between 2002 and 2013. But these numbers are probably low because in so many countries around the globe, human rights monitoring is prohibited. And then in war-torn countries, especially places like Africa, Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe, it's really hard to track this in war-torn areas, so the number is much higher. And so what questions do you have about environmentalists being killed around the globe? If you work in environmental activism, what do you think groups in the U.S. can do to support activists around the globe? And later in the show, we'll talk about what activists in the United States are facing. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. You know, Oliver, what's so interesting about Latin America is a lot of people in the United States consider a lot of the leaders in Latin America to be sympathetic and very friendly toward the indigenous population. And, you know, anti-privatization, for example, they do a lot to protect their environment. So I think maybe some people would be surprised to learn that a lot of these activists are being killed in Latin America. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think anybody who is confronted by what we found would be surprised at the scale of what's happening. I mean, our analysis in countries where this is a particular problem is that you have two forces that generally are coming into conflict. In Brazil, for example, you have a largely export focused economy which is centered around agribusiness and logging to a large extent, and which is increasing. At the same time, you do have powerful movements of people whose association with and affinity with the land is felt very strongly. Their interests are comparatively well represented, and what that does is it brings conflict, and the result of the conflict is that people get killed, and that's what we're seeing in a great number of these countries. So I think whilst it is true in some respects to say that the views are better represented in parts of Latin America than perhaps they are elsewhere, that doesn't mean that what happens as a result of standing up for those rights isn't extremely serious and often fatal. Ultimately, this comes back to how the global economy is increasingly organized around liquidation of natural resources and liquidation of the world's natural assets. And ultimately, those are finite. So unless we collectively, as a planet, can work out ways in which we can wean ourselves off the unsustainable use of natural resources, this kind of problem is going to happen more and more often. Hmm. Peru itself is hosting the next climate change talks, and we will be pointing out very strongly that whilst meetings to make sure that we are using our natural assets and the world and the planet's natural resources sustainably are extremely important, they mean very little unless there are concrete outcomes to protect the environment and the people who depend on it. And that's where we really want to see our focus coming through today. There has to be action at those kind of events.
And Simeon, what would you add to that?
I would absolutely agree that many of the left-wing leaders in Latin America are really not very environmentally... They tend to have a view that it's development or the environment, and they think it's one or the other. There's still obviously a lot of poverty in the region. Millions of Latin Americans go hungry every day, and many of these leaders, very rightly, are committed to reducing and eradicating poverty. But I think the lens that they tend to look at the problem through is maybe not the right one. And one example I would really highlight would be Rafael Correa in Ecuador, who's he's often fated on the left because, of course, Julian Assange has been given asylum by Ecuador. At least he's been able to stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, But within Ecuador, Rafael Correa is, on the one hand, it has to be said, a very popular leader, but he's also been a very polarizing figure, and he tends to thrive on confrontation. And really, there's three groups that he seems to have really managed to pick a fight with within his own country, and those are journalists, environmentalists, and the indigenous community. And, for example, when there have been indigenous protests, there have been anti-terrorism laws used to arrest some of the protesters. One environmental group there was recently shut down by Rafael Correa for criticizing his policies. There's also a $5 billion Chinese mine that Correa is forcing through in a part of the Amazon where the local indigenous communities are pretty much... I think they're ready to lay down their lives in some cases to stop that happening, and basically Correa is determined to push that through. So really I think although from outside it often looks like there's some kind of a natural alliance between the left and between indigenous groups and environmental groups, I think that's not borne out by reality. And I guess the one other thing I just add to that is that I think the left in Latin America has often tended to view indigenous groups, who are often the ones at the forefront of, or at the sharp end, shall we say, of these conflicts about land. The left in the region has tended to view them as some kind of rural working class and not really acknowledge their cultural identity, the fact that most indigenous people see themselves as culturally different, they have strong culture, a language, and they want to hang on to that. And that's something that at least some on the Latin American left, I would say, and especially many who've reached highest office have not really acknowledged sufficiently.
And Oliver, I know we have to let you go soon. In 30 seconds, what can people who care about this issue here do to support activists around the globe?
Well, I think the first port of call has to be governments. People have to be pressurizing their governments to investigate and monitor threats to environmental and human rights defenders. Their cases need to be followed up, they need to be investigated, and they need to be redressed for families. By the same token, companies also have a role to play. We should be pressurizing and asking questions of our companies to make sure that they're doing proper checks on their supply chains, that they aren't sponsoring this kind of abuse, and that they are making sure that they seek the consent of the communities who live on the land that they're looking to operate in before they go ahead with any deal. It's really quite simple in that respect.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have to leave. Oliver Courtney is senior campaigner with Global Witness and lead author of the report, Deadly Environment. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
Many ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call, on the phone, or by sending an email. The address for email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The phone number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in 30 minutes, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. On today's program, a discussion of whether the U.S. was right to swap five Guantanamo Bay detainees for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Does the deal put more American lives at risk, or was it a sign of the high value the U.S. puts on every human life? Also, they'll be chatting about the allegations that Qatar won its bid to stage the 2022 World Cup through bribery and corruption. That's World Have Your Say, coming up in a half an hour here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how tenants can avoid evictions. Because of record high rents and home prices in Northern California, we're seeing so many people evicted. So we'll talk about why this is happening, and we'll talk about what tenants can do to avoid eviction. Some attorneys are saying that a lot of people, especially here in San Francisco, who are being evicted shouldn't. The problem is they just don't know their rights. So that's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the record number of people, environmental activists around the globe, who are being murdered. According to the investigative nonprofit Global Witness, at least 908 environmental activists were murdered in retaliation for their work between 2002 and 2013. But because human rights monitoring is prohibited in many countries, this number is probably low. And the other problem is that governments are not responding. Only 10 perpetrators are known to have been convicted and punished between 2002 and 2013. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this, also, how can we create a movement to protect people who work on environmental issues who are being killed? This issue is not really getting that much attention. Once this report came out, the media did report on it, but Global Witness says the problem is that these murders are not really getting the attention they deserve around the globe. So what questions do you have? How can we connect with other environmentalists on the local level around the globe? And if you're an environmental activist, what are your thoughts on this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by Simeon Teagle. He is Global Post senior correspondent in South America. He writes about a broad range of issues across Latin America, specializing on the environment. And now I would like to welcome Will Potter. He's an award-winning journalist who focuses on the animal rights and environmental movements. And he's author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. So you wrote a piece for Foreign Policy magazine called When an Activist Falls in the Rainforest, Does It Make a Sound? And you focused on an environmental activist and union leader, Chico Mendes. In the days before he was gunned down in the doorway of his home in the Brazilian Amazon, you report that he was a marked man. He had heard that a meeting of ranchers had been called to plan his death. He had seen in his truck's rearview mirror the men who followed him. He told friends in December of 88 that he wouldn't live until Christmas, and he was shot dead a few days later. Tell us a little bit about Chico Mendes.
Well, Chico Mendes, as Andrew Refkin wrote in his book about him called The Burning Season, he was really to the ranchers of the Amazon what Cesar Chavez was to the citrus kings of California. I mean, he was a powerful organizer, so powerful that he's really become this iconic figure in not just Brazil, but this global environmental movement and landowner movement as well, because a lot of the people you talk about or you referenced in the Global Witness report are not necessarily self-professed environmentalists. They're people from indigenous communities that are trying to protect their homes and their families and their ways of life. In a lot of ways, Chico Mendes was a hero to all of them.
Well, I think you bring up a really good point. A lot of these people don't call themselves environmental activists. They're indigenous people who are simply trying to protect their land and their water. Can you elaborate on that a bit and why that's important to point out?
Well, and it's really important to notice because as this environmental destruction is continuing at an ever rapid pace globally, in many cases, the people who are truly on the front lines are these indigenous communities. As corporations are expanding their operations in other countries, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, that's really motivated by a lack of regulations, by so-called new markets and new resources to be exploited. And the people who are living in those areas with those so-called new markets and new resources are these indigenous communities. And in many ways, they're the obstacles to having this unfettered access to the natural world and to exploiting it. And some of the fiercest opposition that has really unfortunately been unnoticed by overwhelmingly, you know, huge populations in the West and globally have been these indigenous communities who have been fighting back for decades and have paid the ultimate price for doing so.
Simeon, can you also talk about that? Global Witness pointed out that part of the problem is that consumption patterns are increasing around the globe. Here in the United States, China, India, and that's another part of the problem. That's why these resources are so important for indigenous people and so important for multinational corporations. So can you talk about the indigenous element of this and why it's important to point out that a lot of these people are not, they don't call themselves environmental activists. They're just doing the work that they have no other choice but to do because their livelihood is at stake.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think, I mean, when we talk about environmentalists being killed, we're not usually talking about PhDs or bright young graduates in the offices of environmental defense or the Nature Conservancy. We're talking about people who come from remote rural communities who may be leaders within their communities or become leaders precisely because they're trying to protect their own land, which is either being seized from them or is being in some way affected, contaminated, polluted by economic activities, extractive activities near them, whether it's mining, logging, ranching, that kind of thing. And they're people that are very vulnerable for a number of reasons. One, socially speaking, they tend to be at the bottom of the pile. They have very limited resources. But also the areas where they are, these are remote frontier areas often in Latin America, especially when you're talking about the Amazon Basin, where really the state in many ways barely reaches them, and that includes through through both law enforcement, the police, and the justice system. And you know, when often as well, these are countries, certainly in Latin America, I imagine it's true in Asia as well, where there is a lot of corruption, and that corruption is often within both the justice system and the police forces that are there. So it's often, when there are investigations, they're very perfunctory, and you may hear an officer, you know, say before he's even begun investigating that, you know, a murder has nothing to do with the environmental activism of the victim. It's just a common crime. So also conviction rates are just, in many of these countries, in these areas, are just unbelievably low. I mean, 10% at the most. In some cases, you may be talking about 1 in 100 murders that are solved. One other thing I'd just like to add, which is, I think, very interesting, you know, talking about Chico Mendes, is that according to a Brazilian group, the Pastoral Land Committee, or CPT by its initials in Portuguese, something like 1,500 people have been killed in Brazil for their environmental activism over the last 25 years. In other words, since Chico Mendes died in Brazil, another 1,500 people in the same country have been killed for their environmental activism. So on the one hand, Chico Mendes, you know, his death was this iconic, was really an iconic moment for the environmental movement. But in many ways, it seems not to have changed very much on the ground at all.
You wrote last year a piece in Global Post called Latin America is the Most Dangerous Place for Environmentalists, and you started your piece focusing on the anti-mining activist Cleof Neira, and she talked about the repeated death threats from anonymous callers to her cell phones. She said, quote, "They said they would be waiting for me, that they would rape and kill me. She's 53. It was traumatic, of course. You think the worst. You think about your family, your husband, your kids. You have to stay strong, but it's very difficult to avoid letting it affect you." She said, "Thank God I am still here." Can you give us an update on her?
Basically her situation hasn't changed that much since I wrote the story, because her experience was something that had happened a couple of years earlier, and there hadn't been much movement on the case. But what is a fact is that she was getting these death threats on her phone and people knocking on her door, and no one has ever been brought to justice for that.
That is Simeon Teagle. He's Global Post senior correspondent for South America, focusing on issues affecting the environment. Will Potter is an award-winning journalist who focuses on the animal rights and environmental movements. He's author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And we're talking about a new report from Global Witness that found at least 908 environmental activists around the globe were murdered in retaliation for their work between 2002 and 2013. It's important to point out that many of these people are indigenous rights activists. They're indigenous, living in places like Latin America, for example, defending their land and their water. And you can find the report at yourcallradio.org. You can also join us at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about environmental activists being killed around the globe, we'd love to hear from you. If you work working to protect the environment here in the U.S., what do you think we can do to try to express solidarity with these activists and try to get this more attention? Because until this report came out, other than in places where it was happening, it wasn't getting that much attention. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also going to talk about what environmentalists in the United States are facing. And let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Rose and your guest. You know, I wonder if they're familiar with the Landsat satellite technology that's able to discover minerals in the ground from satellites. The early NASA program of decades ago developed weather maps and whatnot, but they figured out that by looking at the ground from above and changing various filters, you could actually see lead or copper minerals of various types in the ground. Well, after 9/11, that information became top secret. And I would expect that with the privatization of NASA and whatnot, the biggest mining companies in the world know this already, but the public is kept away from that knowledge. So if some given country in the world has some given minerals underneath the ground, are the mining companies coming up with private armies and stirring up private wars in order to drive people off the land, but knowing full well that there are minerals in the ground that people are sitting on top of? And as an adjunct, one of your guests is involved with Native Americans. I'm wondering, with Native Americans having a treaty, they're basically nations of their own. And I'm wondering if they would have the ability to approach the United Nations to get this information released.
All right, thank you. Will, have you heard of anything like this?
Not really. I mean, I think it really speaks to some bigger themes that we're talking about, though, of kind of a disproportionate power dynamic that's really kind of undergirding all of these issues, and that, you know, even when we're talking about bringing these legal challenges and such, it's about access to resources, it's about access to attorneys, and it's about legal systems that are really built against these communities in many ways. So, I mean, at least in my research and in this article for Foreign Policy, what I saw time and again is when these communities are attempting to be organized, whether it's through direct action, resistance, through legal action, every step of the way there are attempts being made to disempower them and push them out of their communities again and again. So I think it really speaks to some broader issues of, exactly like the caller said, whether or not these corporations know what's going on or are misleading governments and communities, I wouldn't be shocked at all. But it's even more troubling to me the methods that are in place, regardless, to enforce their will.
And Will, in your foreign policy piece, you point out that there is a well-documented history of violence against environmentalists in Western countries, which is not included in the Global Witness report. You point out that in the United States, a young environmentalist named David Chain was killed in 1998 when a logger felled an old growth tree in his direction. Moments before, the logger was recorded on video saying that if protesters didn't move, he would, quote, make sure I got a tree coming this way, end quote. David Chain was crushed and killed, and the local district attorney refused to press charges against the logger.
Yeah, and there has been this history. Now, it really, in a lot of ways, that type of violence pales in comparison to what these communities, especially in, as we heard earlier, Brazil is far and away one of the most dangerous countries in the world for this type of issue. But we're seeing this globally, and I think one of the issues that was raised in the Global Witness report that's especially chilling is that I think we're going to be seeing more of this retaliation, both in the courts, in communities, and with outright violence as competition for resources increases, as the state of the environment globally becomes more dire. I think this is going to become a more pressing issue.
Do you agree with that, Simeon? In many of the stories, activists say if governments do not take action, they're basically sending a message that it is okay to kill environmental activists.
No, absolutely. I think impunity is one of the main factors fueling this. I mean, obviously, we've talked about, on the one hand, humankind's growing need for resources and growing consumption. But I think on the other side, you have to look at the fact that certainly in Latin America, and I imagine it's the case in Africa and certain countries in Asia, especially the Philippines, for example, that has this problem, that the state is not living up to its responsibilities. There isn't justice when someone is killed. There isn't justice. The police don't do, usually, not always, of course, but don't do a good job or a thorough job investigating, or an impartial job investigating, and then the justice system doesn't do its job either. I mean, when you have high-profile cases like the murder of Dorothy Stang, where it becomes an international outcry, then. And for example, you know, you'll have the Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, or at the time Lula da Silva. Basically, it's brought to their attention. They, in those cases, yes, there will be thorough investigations. Usually, maybe not always, but most of these killings, there's never that kind of international outcry. There may not even be an outcry in their own countries. Certainly, nothing that necessarily reaches the capital. So, I mean, I think that's one major issue, is that these countries, they need to reform their judicial systems, their police, and they need to start dedicating much more resources to it to make sure that there is justice.
You mentioned Dorothy Stang. She was the American nun who was killed in 2005?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and a Brazilian rancher was charged with her murder. He was sentenced to 30 years in jail?
He was. I haven't followed that case too closely recently, but there was an acquittal, I think, in that case. So even there was. One of the other things to understand is that in Latin America, the justice system is very different from what you have in the U.S., and it's much more complicated cases here, and there aren't quick resolutions, and cases often end up open-ended as well. So you often don't end up with a simple, clear ending or conclusion to cases here.
And Dorothy Stang spent three decades trying to preserve the rainforest and defend the rights of poor settlers who confronted ranchers seeking their land in the Amazon. I just pulled up a story about Dorothy Stang. So what are your thoughts about activists working in the Amazon? I mean, this is 30% of animal species and plants in the world are in the Amazon, and a lot of multinationals are trying to get the resources there. So, I mean, there's that issue, and then there's also the issue of the collusion between governments and these multinationals. Right, Simeon?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, one of the issues, for example, in the Dorothy Stang case was that, and others, is that I think the Brazilian Congress, doesn't appear particularly interested sometimes in addressing these cases. Brazil also recently rewrote its forest code, which basically environmentalists were very critical of, and basically said that had effectively legalized more deforestation. So I think there is a lot of corruption that goes on, and political decisions are very much influenced by the money that the big companies, mining corporations, and other corporations have. Sometimes it's legal above the table. Campaign donations, one can question whether it's legitimate, but it's legal. But often there's kickbacks and bribes under the table. And so, I mean, that just goes to what Will was speaking about this completely unequal access to resources and to power between the communities where these leaders who are being killed are coming from, and I guess the power structures and the politicians in their country's capitals.
So given these realities, Will, given that the governments aren't doing anything to convict and punish the perpetrators, again, only 10 perpetrators have been convicted and punished between 2002 and 2013, and 908 activists killed, what can people do to try to raise awareness about this and pressure governments to take action so this doesn't continue happening?
Well, I think that's exactly the challenge. I think if more people had any idea of what was taking place globally in this way, there would be massive public outrage. I mean, people are not only sympathetic to these issues, I think people are overwhelmingly very well aware of the disproportionate power that corporations have both in the United States and around the world. And I think raising awareness about these issues, there's a lot of potential there. It also speaks to, a huge challenge, though, that we all face of when we're just confronting these massive global problems, what is the best way to take action on them, especially for your listeners in the Bay? I mean, how do you speak out about violence that's taking place thousands of miles away? And I think a lot of it is that education and solidarity, and it's also being as active as possible in your own community on the issues that you can be most effective about. In a lot of ways, I think the most powerful way to change this culture globally is by getting involved in our own capacities at the community level to contribute to that discussion.
And what would you add to that, Simeon?
I would agree with that, and I think there are things that people in the U.S. can do that can make a difference in other parts of the world. And one example I would give is that Peru actually has an environment ministry. That may not sound like a big deal, but it's actually it is for Peru. It only was created in 2008, and the reason it was created was because it was a condition of a trade treaty, so-called free trade treaty with the U.S. And the U.S. Basically made that a condition because there were environmental groups in the U.S. Pressuring and campaigning for that against their own government in Washington. And so now Peru has an environment ministry. It's weak. It doesn't have too many resources, but it does at least have that, and there are people there in the ministry working within government to try and bring about changes. When you look at the power and the resources the environment ministry has here compared to, for example, the Ministry for Energy and Mines, it's completely disproportionate. But that's one small step, and they are making a difference here.
We have an email from Linda who says, it happens here too. Don't forget about Judy Berry, who was bombed in her car in 1990. Both she and her companion were badly injured. They were both arrested and charged with planning a bombing. Judy and her friend were active in defending the West Coast Redwoods from being clear-cut by lumber companies. No one has been charged with attempted murder of Judy and her friend. Thank you for calling. There's actually a documentary about that called Who Bombed Judy Berry. Judy was with her friend Daryl Cherney, and they actually sued the FBI and won more than $4 million in damages. And the question remains, who bombed Judy Berry? So thanks for the email. And Will, you point out in your piece that in the United States, you write, the mercenaries often hired to silence environmental activists are not assassins. They're lawyers and lobbyists. Companies like TransCanada are briefing police on how to prosecute nonviolent pipeline protesters as terrorists. In Oklahoma, environmental activists are facing 10 years in prison. because they unfurled a banner in a corporate headquarters and some glitter fell off the banner to the floor. Police say they had no idea the glitter wasn't a chemical weapon, so that amounted to a terrorism hoax. And now many states across the country are passing laws that make it illegal for environmentalists and animal welfare activists to videotape factory farms. So environmental activists are also facing a lot of intimidation here in the United States. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is really a global attack and on the entire, and anyone who's speaking out effectively in defense of the environment or animals as well. And I think it really speaks to the fact that this isn't just about one specific tactic. It's about all of the tactics that these industries can use to silence their opposition. And really, those tactics are chosen based on what is acceptable and allowed in different states. I mean, as Simeon said, you know, in these many Latin American countries, there's absolutely zero enforcement. There's no prosecution. There's been a handful of them. So these industries and their mercenaries know that if this violence takes place, it can be carried out with relative impunity. Similarly, in the U.S., I mean, that's not as possible. Obviously, there are different restrictions. There's more visibility because of the status of the U.S. and white environmentalists overwhelmingly in the U.S. as well plays a hand in that. Mm. But there are other tactics that they can use. I mean, prosecuting them as terrorists, reshaping the law, using FBI resources to surveil and harass protesters, and now even to criminalize photography as well. So I think it really speaks to, no matter where they are, pushing the limits of the law as much as possible and going even further outside of the law.
And animal rights groups have told activists, do not go undercover into factory farms, for example, because we do not have the money to defend you. So just don't do it, period. Right?
And that's the unfortunate reality. I mean, these industries in many countries around the world and in the U.S. are more than willing to operate outside of the law to pursue their profits and protect their interests. But when it comes to these national nonprofits, they're not able to do that. Mm. I mean, groups like the Humane Society or the Sierra Club cannot be seen openly embracing lawbreaking. So if this is the law of the land, they really are put in a bind of having to respect that. Mm.
And Simeon, final thoughts from you. Is this issue getting much attention in the Peruvian media?
No, not at all. And I mean, one of the things to understand about the Peruvian society in general and the media here is that Lima, this city on the coast of 9 million, roughly a third of the population, in many ways is quite cut off from the Andes and the Amazon here. And the decisions that are made about what goes on in the Andes and the Amazon, whether it's mining or logging or damming rivers, these are made in Lima, these decisions, often by people who've never been to the areas where the decisions are going to be implemented. And that's really mirrored as well by the national press here, which it's called a national press, but really I think it's very divided between the media that are based in Lima and provincial media.
Simeon Teagle is Global Post senior correspondent for South America, and Will Potter is an award-winning journalist, author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What can tenants do to protect themselves from being evicted? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the rise of evictions in the Bay Area. Because home prices and rents are reaching new highs, longtime tenants are facing evictions across Northern California. Evictions in San Francisco are at their highest level since 2001, prompting the state legislature to take on the issue. So what resources do tenants have to fight evictions? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.